in the November 2024 presidential elections. That would be, to use their terminology, the game changer, because the US political power is much more meaningful to Washington than this attempt to destroy Russia economically, politically, geographically, etc.
All right, and on that note, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Glenn Deason, professor of political science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. Greg Simmons, independent researcher and author out of Sweden. And we appreciate you, as always, being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A young Palestinian man dies of injuries he sustained during a last month Israeli raid on the West Bank city of Jenin. Russia says its military cooperation with Iran will continue without succumbing to US dictates. Also coming from Russia, the country shoots down more than 70 Ukrainian drones over its territory. Our top story this hour, a young Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin last month. The 20-year-old man, identified as Izzeddin Kanaan, was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper. He was on his way to donate blood to the victims of the Israeli raid. Israel launched the deadly aerial and ground attacks on the Jenin refugee camp in early July. It was the regime's fiercest incursion into the West Bank in two decades. The two-day onslaught left over a dozen Palestinians killed before the regime troops were forced to withdraw due to retaliatory operations by resistance fighters. Israeli forces carry out attacks against Palestinians in the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The regime has killed at least 230 Palestinians since the start of the year, and arrested many others. The Hamas resistance movement has vowed a swift response to Israeli attacks against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. A Hamas spokesperson described the raids as a violation of sanctities and freedom of worship. He added that the Israeli regime is deluded if it assumes it can force the Palestinians to leave by committing such crimes. On Friday, Israeli forces attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque with tear gas and rubber bullets. At least eight Palestinians, including an elderly person, were injured. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Muna Kandil, tells us about the Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, particularly on Fridays.
Israeli forces continue to make Palestinians' access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Fridays a little bit difficult for the residents of Al-Quds by preventing Palestinian activists, by preventing young Palestinians, whether female or male Palestinians, to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex by setting more checkpoints and sending more Israeli forces at the military checkpoints leading to the Old Town and leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where a number of Israeli forces today, Friday, had been stationing at the numerous gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank are not allowed to enter Al-Quds for even visiting this holy city or to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque without getting Israeli issued permits. And it's something maybe it's impossible for Palestinians to get, mainly with the increased Israeli practices and measures against the Palestinians all across the occupied West Bank.
Moving on now, President Ibrahim Raisi hails Iran's admission to the BRICS group of five major emerging economies. He says Iran's cooperation with BRICS and similar organizations have major benefits for the country.
Iran's membership in BRICS will increase the country's political power. Cooperation with powerful international organizations will boost Iran's political power, in addition to bringing economic benefits for the country.
Raisi added that the accession is in line with Iran's national interests. The Iranian president also lauded the role of new emerging blocs such as BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in confronting unilateralism. Raisi made the remarks upon arrival in Tehran after taking part in a BRICS summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. There, the bloc's leaders invited Iran and five other countries, including Saudi Arabia, to join the group.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization.
The BRICS group accounts for 26% of global gross domestic product. The bloc considers itself a counterweight to Western powers. It is also opposed to the use of financial payment systems for political purposes. For that reason, BRICS leaders have all backed the idea of using local currencies to facilitate trade. They have also plans to create a unified currency as an alternative to the dollar.
The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran, have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West, could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Now, Iran's army has held large-scale electronic warfare drills in the country's central areas. The Navy, the Air Force, and the ground forces took part in the exercises. The drills involved assessing various types of systems used in electronic warfare. They included fixed, mobile, ground-based, and airborne systems. The exercises also featured the Iranian army's various drones, micro-aerial vehicles, and other military equipment. The commander of the drill said Iran is boosting its defensive and offensive capabilities. Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari stressed that Iran has no intention to attack any country, but would respond decisively to any aggression. Russia says it will continue its military ties with Iran regardless of the U.S. and its satellites' attempts to undermine the relations. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said the military cooperation between Tehran and Moscow will not succumb to geopolitical pressure. He further emphasized that there have been no changes in the collaboration within the military sector between the two sides. This statement follows reports earlier this month that Washington has requested Iran to cease selling drones to Russia. The U.S. and some of its allies previously accused Moscow of utilizing Iranian drones in its conflict with Ukraine, allegations which Tehran has consistently denied. Additionally, Iran has criticized any attempts to link its military cooperation with Russia to the Ukraine war, asserting that a diplomatic and dialogical resolution should be sought for the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Russia says it has thwarted new Ukrainian drone and missile attacks in different regions of the country.
Over the past 24 hours, five HIMARS multiple rocket launchers and a U.S.-made HARM anti-radar missile were intercepted, as well as one converted S-200 anti-aircraft guided missile. Also, 73 Ukrainian unmanned drones were shot down and suppressed by means of electronic warfare.
The Defense Ministry spokesman also said that Russia destroyed a Ukrainian port infrastructure facility used for military purposes. Crimea and Moscow have been the main targets of the Ukrainian airstrikes on Russian territory since May. Russia has launched its own air attacks on Ukrainian soil as well, mainly targeting the capital Kiev and southern regions. Turning elsewhere now, the number of bankruptcy declarations of EU businesses keeps soaring at a fast pace. If Eastern European countries have been recording the highest rates over the past months, the situation in Italy has been worrying for years. Max Cividi is in Rome.
The EU statistical agency Eurostat's latest report on business registrations and bankruptcies leaves little room for interpretation. Small and medium businesses across the old continent are struggling amid the unprecedented challenges posed by some global events such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the energy crisis, high levels of inflation and high interest rates. Bankruptcy declarations in the European Union reached the highest level since 2015 in the second quarter of this year. The number of closures in the April-June period was 8% higher than the previous quarter, marking a sixth consecutive increase. Hungary, Latvia and Estonia have recorded the highest number of enterprises declaring bankrupt in 2023.
It is important to stress that Eastern European countries benefited enormously from delocalization over the past two decades. Today, the enduring effects of the many crises are also evident on the Eastern Europe.
A sharp increase in the number of bankruptcy declarations has been recorded in the accommodation and food services sectors across the whole old continent. Registrations of new businesses are declining. The clock is ticking in Italy as well. The Confederation of Italian Enterprises, Confindustria, has reported that about 120,000 companies in Italy are facing bankruptcy and as many as 370,000 jobs are at stake. Soaring gas and energy prices, high inflation and the rising cost of borrowing money have worsened an already difficult situation. For over 15 years, the exit rate of companies in the country has been much higher than the entry rate. According to the authoritative agency CERVED, hundreds of thousands of companies have closed and millions of jobs have gone wasted since 2008. CERVED estimates that about 3 million workers risk losing their jobs in the coming months.
In his maiden speech to the Upper House in 2021, former Prime Minister Mario Draghi pointed out that a new selective industrial policy discussed by the members of the G30 was needed to limit the rising number of the so-called zombie companies, those firms unable to pay their long-term debts. It goes without saying that Italy's workers and small and medium-sized enterprises, which account for the vast majority of Italian firms, are bearing the brunt of this policy.
Our Western economic systems are connected like communicating vessels. In my view, things will get worse as the vessels are connected too tightly.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine and the curtailment of Russian pipeline gas supplies to Europe, companies in energy-intensive sectors have been the most affected. Max Civili, Rome.
That report wraps up World News for this hour.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions. as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
A new study has shown that the top 1% of Americans are responsible for 15% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. According to the study, 15 days for a household in 1/10% emits more than the lifetime of a household in the bottom 10%. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, the richest households are responsible for a vast disproportionate share of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. According to the study published recently in PLOS Climate, the richest 10% of U.S. households are responsible for over 40% of the nation's total greenhouse gas emissions. Further, the top 1% alone account for between 15 and 17% of emissions. In order to arrive at this conclusion, study authors looked at not only household wages, but also investments to determine household wealth and their climate emissions. Doing this, lead author Jared Starr said, allowed researchers to examine how income-generating methods contribute to the climate crisis rather than focusing on consumption. Starr said in a statement, consumption-based approaches to limiting greenhouse gas emissions are regressive. They disproportionately punish the poor while having little impact on the extremely wealthy who tend to save and invest a large share of their income. Consumption-based approaches miss something important. Carbon pollution generates income, but when that income is reinvested into stocks rather than spent on necessities, it isn't subject to a consumption-based carbon tax. Starr, a sustainability researcher at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, went on to turn the traditional question of how carbon emissions are generated and their link to income on its head. Starr asked, what happens when we focus on how emissions create income rather than how they enable consumption? The study looked at 30 years of data to determine how investments can support direct and indirect emissions. The study authors examined investment income from a power plant, for instance, which produces emissions both at the power plant and downstream on the supply chain. The higher the income bracket, the higher the proportion of emissions that comes from investment income. The study found, further, white Americans had the largest carbon impact, while black households had the lowest share of emissions. researchers also looked at a group they categorized as super emitters, who create an extremely high amount of emissions per household. They found that almost all super emitters were from the top 0.1% of household income. Starr said, "This research gives us insight into the way that income and investments obscure emissions responsibility. For example, 15 days of income for a top 0.1% percentage household generates as much carbon pollution as a lifetime of income for a household in the bottom 10%. An income-based lens helps us focus in on exactly who is profiting the most from climate-changing carbon pollution and design policies to shift their behavior." According to The Hill, the wealthiest tenth of U.S. households are the source of 40% of national greenhouse gas emissions, according to research published in the journal PLOS Climate. Researchers, led by Jared Starr of the University of Massachusetts, analyzed 3 decades of household income data from 1990 to 2019. They found that during this period, the bottom 90% of households' share of emissions has fallen, while the top 10% share has increased. The wealthiest 1% of households were responsible for between 15% and 17% emissions. Starr and colleagues analyzed emissions associated with businesses owned by households they analyzed, but also factored in revenues relating to their investments. For the top 10%, investment income makes up a large share of those household emissions, between 38% and 42% in the case of the wealthiest 10%. Starr told The Hill in an exclusive interview, "The investment piece makes up an increasing share of the emissions responsibility as we look further up the income ladder." Just over 43% of the wealthiest 0.1% of households, 34%, were what the researchers dubbed super emitters, or those responsible for more than 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions per year. They also found wide racial disparities in responsibility for emissions, with non-Hispanic white households comprising the highest income-linked emissions and black households comprising the lowest. According to Hill, emissions also varied by age cohort, peaking between the ages of 45 and 64 and then declining. The results indicate that policymakers may have been looking at potential carbon taxes and their structure from the wrong angle. While consumer-facing carbon taxes have struggled to move from proposal to law in the U.S., an investment-based carbon tax may be more equitable, politically palatable, and equally justifiable, they wrote, while acknowledging that this would likely face pushback from the disproportionate amount of the wealthiest Americans in politics. They wrote, "By thinking of carbon as an outcome of income generation rather than just an outcome of consumption, such alternative policy solutions become possible."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Digital footprint.
Part 1.
In early 1921, Charlie Chaplin was on the silver screen with a new movie. A vagrant poor man accidentally finds a kid on the street. The kid has to work and live with the vagrant man. Chaplin's movie soon stole the limelight. Funny moments were only one aspect of the movie. What caught the attention of the audience was the acting of that young boy, a young and talented actor named Jackie Coogan. He had the ability to make the audience cry in the midst of a comedy. Those days, Chaplin's movie sold over $5 million, and now everyone talking about Jackie Coogan. He had become a new shining star and received many offers. Jackie became famous and at the same time rich. In just a decade, the famous kid in Chaplin's movie earned almost $4 million. Everything was going well for Jackie Coogan until 1935. Jackie had turned 21, and he noticed something strange. The incident affected all of his life. Jackie had come of age and wanted to own the huge wealth. But there was a big problem. In fact, there was no money so he could use. Jackie's parents had received their son's salary and spent it during the past 15 years. But that wasn't the only problem. Rumors about behind the scenes in Chaplin's movie spread again. Some say Jackie's cry and anxiety in that famous scene was real, because his father had threatened him if he did not cry properly, he'd take him to an orphanage. Jackie filed a complaint to get back his money, but it was to no avail. They gave him back only $126,000. Now he had to start from scratch after years of hard work. The story of his life was so bitter that made some people ask a question as old as history. Do parents have the right to use their children for business? From the dawn of civilization, children have been forced to work. But at the turn of the 18th century, things changed. The Industrial Revolution that had started in Britain laid the foundations for establishing more factories. The factories needed cheap, full-time, and fresh labor force. Children had all of these qualities. They were the best choice to push the wheels of the Industrial Revolution. The majority of boys worked in coal mines, and most of the girls in textile factories. In Britain, they wouldn't even exploit four-year-old kids. After a while, the trend moved on to the United States as well.
In the early 20th century in the U.S., 26% of boys between 10 and 15 worked in factories. They usually had to work between 12 and 16 hours a day. Some factories would lock the doors so the laborers wouldn't run away. In some others, there was no room for hygienic or safety protocols. It is estimated that in 1900, about 7.1 million children were exploited in various sectors in the U.S. But a few years later, changes got underway. With the advent of new businesses like the cinema industry, the situation changed for children as well. That's why no one was surprised that Jackie Coogan had become famous. Jackie was considered the representative of a large population of children who were employed with the new tactic that has continued to exist until today.
Jules Lund used to work in television as a presenter. Now he connects influencers to the marketplace and feels we ain't seen nothing yet. It is, though, a pretty crowded market already. How do you cut through?
You think it's a crowded market, but it's not even close.
Really?
Yeah. What you've got to imagine is years ago, the attention of the masses was held by a few TV networks or a few radio networks or print, whereas now the attention of the masses is held by everyday people.
Hi, Susie, and welcome to Ryan's World.
Ryan Kaji is born in 2011 in Texas, the U.S. He's a 10-year-old kid who's known as one of the highest-earning YouTubers. In 2020, Ryan managed to earn $30 million from YouTube. Now he's turned into an outstanding figure. He creates visual content about toys. As Ryan unboxes the toys and sometimes talks about them, his subscribers increase by the day. He's been creating the videos along with his family since he was 4. He owns the most famous channel that introduces toys. Over 30 million subscribers and 48 billion visitors of Ryan's YouTube channel led to the creation of toy and clothes production lines. Furthermore, Ryan and his family have direct and indirect advertisement as well. The Federal Trade Commission has recently started an investigation on Ryan. Some of the sponsors had not been disclosed, and some of the advertised products were not healthy. These are the latest controversial issues about him. Despite all this, Ryan is known as an influencer who will pile up his wealth day by day.
They are basically adopting a don't ask, don't tell stance about all the children that are on their site, but at the same time, they're profiting enormously by hosting content that is deliberately designed to attract kids.
YouTube, based on whatever percentage they're getting of that, is probably making $10 to $15 million just off of Ryan's videos. Particularly on YouTube, we have been concerned about the rise of unboxing culture and, you know, how people like Ryan and EvanTube have become such powerful forces in children's lives. If you are a child and you are unboxing a toy because you've been paid to promote it, then your whole 12-minute unboxing video is an ad. Children don't have that understanding, and they have it even less when the person telling them this is masquerading as their friend on YouTube who's just really excited about opening a toy.
Ryan isn't the only famous child on YouTube. Anastasia, who's 7 years old, also has a YouTube channel with 107 million subscribers and 61 billion visitors. She's also been one of the strange phenomena in recent years.
You have 75 million subscribers on YouTube.
Wow!
Have you met all of them?
No, but I'm gonna look for
them. In 2020, she earned $18 million. According to statistics, in 2019, influencers pocketed nearly $8 billion. The figure reached $15 billion the following year. As it looks, children like Ryan and Anastasia form a significant part of the industry.
YouTubers might be getting paid $15,000 to $50,000 per sponsored video. Influencer marketing is one of the fastest growing segments, so I think they're estimating over the next couple of years it'll grow to $24 billion.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. And our company only plays a small role in that, but we've already paid out $20 million just to everyday micro-influencers simply for taking photos on their phone celebrating brands they already use and love. So you can start to see the absolute opportunity.
YouTube isn't the only place you can find children influencers. Instagram has also been an active platform for these children. These children's activities are totally different from Anastasia and Ryan. For example, the Wixens boys have their own stories. For years, the three brothers' mother has been posting their pictures on her Instagram page. A few years ago, Ms. Wixon decided to share her children's daily pictures. At first, she used to post ordinary pictures of their trips and happy moments within family. But gradually, things changed. More and more people followed the page because of the boys' attractive pictures. Ms. Wixon received advertisement offers. Now her page with several hundred followers looked like any other family account. The boys can be seen in different situations, but this is just what you see on the surface. Behind the scenes, a professional photographer, a sponsor, and many goods are hidden to be advertised. From foodstuffs and hygienic products to clothing and toys. It isn't clear how much the Wixons earn from this page, but what is certain is the boys are always there. If it wasn't for Ms. Wixon's sons, the page wouldn't be able to earn thousands of dollars every month. But earning money through children is just one side of the story. The other side of the coin is an important development that will reveal itself in the future.
Dad, I feel a little drops.
It's all right. It's a little rain, baby. It's all right. You got a jacket on. It'll protect you. You warm?
Yeah.
Good.
Josh Biggs is Taylan's manager, her bodyguard, and her dad. When this photo was posted on Instagram when Taylan was around 10 months old, their lives were about to change.
Fashion Kids, which was a big platform on Instagram, saw the photo, liked the photo. Next thing you know, the Kardashians came along somehow at 18 months old. They picked her up to get involved with their kids' clothing line. And then, you know, she grew into what she's doing now. 3 years old, walked the runway, youngest runway model in the world at Gotham Hall, New York Fashion Week, and she's kind of just taking New York Fashion Week by storm.
Sharing children's pictures on the internet is an important issue that starts even before they're born. Some parents start their job with ultrasound pictures, and then it comes to shopping for the baby. And then the pictures of the mother who's waiting in the doctor's office. But that's not all. Even if a couple doesn't want to spread the news that they're going to have a baby on the internet, they won't succeed. The search algorithms on the internet find out about the pregnancy of a mother even before gynecologists. As soon as you type the first few words, the algorithms start their mission. From searching for a gynecologist's office to finding the symptoms of a disease, their job is to expose you to advertisements related to giving birth. This is what they do business with. when the search algorithms realize that you're about to give birth to a baby, something else happens as well. It will record your baby's first presence on the internet, the first footprint that will have a strange effect on the baby's future. Concealing pregnancy from the internet is as hard as raising children away from it.
Ava Ryan was 2 years old when her mum Katie posted this video on Facebook for the rest of her family to watch.
Never in a million years would have thought that that would translate to anyone. To me, it was just like super nonsensical toddler talk that I thought was funny. And I posted it on Facebook and my aunt was like, oh, you need to, that would go viral. And I'm like, you're crazy. Like, there's no way in the world that would go viral. And it did.
To date, the video has had more than 600,000 views on Facebook and another 8 million views on YouTube.
I smell like beef.
And all for you saying one line.
Yeah, I smell like beef.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I just said I smelled like beef because I actually did. I smelled like the grill. So I just said I smell like beef. I don't know why I said that, but, you know.
You just said it over and over and people loved it.
I just said it over and over and people loved it. So, yeah, that's cool.
So that's what we call viral. That's when a video goes viral, right?
Viral.
Posting the pictures of children posted by their parents has turned into a challenging issue during the past 10 years. Some people say parents are free to share their children's pictures, but some others believe that the children's privacy is violated by doing so. What will happen if children are not happy that their parents have published their private pictures after they grew up? The internet is brimming with pictures and videos of children. The pictures of eating food, smiling, crying, sleeping, or their illness. Parents gradually shape their children's identity by sharing their pictures. A 2-year-old kid cannot even pronounce the word the internet, but tens of thousands of strangers might know everything about their behavioral habits. Some old statistics show that over 80% of children under 2 years old in the U.S. are in the digital world in this way. Parents don't post their children's pictures with ill intentions, but good intentions don't count in this matter that much. By doing so, the children's digital footprints will be complete. Today's babies and children will be tomorrow's teenagers. Sooner or later, they themselves will become internet users. So their first encounter with the internet can be scary. They'll see hundreds of pictures of themselves only in a few seconds, hundreds of pictures of their birthday parties, crawling and playing, the pictures of their illness, getting wounded, crying, and thousands of other circumstances and events in the past. Their digital footprints related to the past years will quickly surface thanks to search engines. People have seen those pictures thousands of times and have left comments. Under those circumstances, children are faced with a past they didn't have any role to create. But the bitter reality is, most of the pictures are published by those who are close to the children. Parents shape their children's lifestyle and their digital identity as they wish. But posting the pictures form the identity of not only the children, but also their parents. By showing their children, they try to complete the missing pieces of their own identity for others. In this identity, children are a tool and not a new family member, so the parents can show off.
Thank you.
in the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has confirmed he would turn himself in on Thursday, 24th of August, in Fulton County, Georgia, after he was indicted on charges stemming from his efforts to hold on to power after the 2020 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The U.S. national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump said on Monday night that he would turn himself in on Thursday, 24th of August, in Fulton County, Georgia, after he was indicted on sprawling charges stemming from his efforts to hold on to office in the wake of the 2020 election. "Can you believe it? I'll be going to Atlanta, Georgia on Thursday to be arrested by a radical left district attorney, Fannie Willis," Trump wrote on his social media platform, Truth Social. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who launched the investigation into Donald Trump and his allies, has given the defendants until noon on Friday, 25th of August, to surrender themselves voluntarily. Fannie Willis last week hit Donald Trump and 18 other people with racketeering charges, accusing them of scheming to overturn the results of the 2020 election, and gave the defendants until Friday to surrender voluntarily at the Rice Street Jail. Three senior law enforcement officials said on Friday that they expected Donald Trump to surrender later on this week. In a news released on Monday, the Fulton County Sheriff's Office said that when he does turn himself in, there will be a hard lockdown of the area surrounding the Rice Street Jail. Donald Trump earlier on Monday agreed to a $200,000 bond under the terms of the consent bond order filed in court on Monday afternoon. 21st of August, he agreed to the bond amount on charges that include racketeering, criminal conspiracy, criminal solicitation, filing false documents and making false statements. Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee signed off on the order, which was signed by Fannie Willis and Donald Trump's attorneys. It says Trump shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. It also says the defendant shall make no direct or indirect threat to any nature of any nature against the community or to any property in the community. The above shall include, but are not limited to, posts on social media or reposts of posts made by another individual on social media. The document was filed after members of Trump's legal team, Drew Feinding, Marissa Goldberg, and Jennifer Little, were spotted entering the Fulton County Courthouse around in the afternoon, walking in the direction of the district attorney's office. They declined to comment to reporters on their way in. Other defendants agreed to bond packages with prosecutors on Monday as well. As of late Monday afternoon, 21st of August, Donald Trump's was the only one that Fannie Willis had signed off on. Her deputy signed the others. His was also the only one with terms that included not making threats to the community or on social media sites. John Eastman, the lawyer charged with helping to orchestrate Trump's fake electoral scheme, agreed to a $100,000 bond on charges including racketeering, criminal conspiracy, and filing false documents. Judge McAfee signed off on the agreement on Monday morning. Under the terms of his order, John Eastman shall report to pretrial supervision every 30 days and shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her to be a co-defendant or witness in this case or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. The order also holds that Eastman shall not communicate in any way, directly or indirectly, about the facts of this case with any person known to him to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, except through his or her counsel. conditions that Donald Trump has also agreed to. John Eastman, who is referred to but not charged as a co-conspirator in special counsel Jack Smith's federal criminal case against Trump for allegedly trying to subvert the 2020 election results, features prominently and repeatedly in the district attorney's indictment. It alleges that Eastman helped come up with and carry out a scheme to have alternate presidential electors cast their votes for Donald Trump in Georgia and several other states that Joe Biden had won. John Eastman's lawyer, Harvey Silverglade, said in a statement last week that the charges against his client and the 18 other defendants set out activity that is political but not criminal, and that Eastman should not have been charged. Another architect of the electoral scheme named as a defendant, lawyer Kenneth Chesbrough, struck a similar deal, agreeing to a $100,000 bond. Ray Smith, another Trump lawyer who was allegedly involved in the fake electoral scheme, agreed to a $50,000 bond order. Judge McAfee also signed off on